The Sunday sales bill dies. Who should consumers be mad at? The governor wades into the debate over gambling, or does he? The Indiana House casts a big vote for a soccer stadium, and some students in Newcastle side with Glenda Ritz. That plus Mike Pence at CPAC, Miss Watermelon, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending February 27, 2015. Programming
is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.
This week, the bill calling for Sunday alcohol sales died in the General Assembly. It lost its biggest supporters, retailers who compete with packaged liquor stores, when they weren't willing to face new restrictions 7 days a week in exchange for Sunday sales. So the author of the bill, Republican Tom Dermody of LaPorte, killed it himself by deciding that he wouldn't call for a vote in the Indiana House. Supporters who began this session with high hopes are back to square one. I asked Dermody why he didn't call for a vote anyway, and he said he learned what he needed to know when an amendment failed last week.
And then talking with members, I don't think there's a necessary requirement to add that fuel to the fire when I know I don't have the support for the bill.
It's sad for consumers when they were not able to get the simple ability to purchase alcoholic beverages on Sunday like they can the other 6 days of the week.
Opening 8 hours a day on Sunday would have been about a $420,000 cost to Big Red, with no promise of increased sales.
Will Sunday sales ever come to Indiana? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Dan Parker, Republican Tim Berry, John Schwannis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV Statehouse reporter Jim Shella. I know my name. Tim Berry, how long will it take for Sunday sales to become legal here?
Well, I think there are some people that have been waiting for a long time for it but don't understand why not. But then on the other hand, there are a lot of different sides to this position. And certainly Representative Dermody had some concerns about access and availability, and at the end of the day, just couldn't get all sides to come together.
Well, this is a turf war. This is all about market share. And what happened, I believe, is that the package store owners won again.
You could say that. I mean, it's really a fairness issue if you look at it from the package liquor store perspective. The amount of money that they have to pay for a license, the training they have to give their employees, those same restrictions don't apply to the other folks who sell. So if you want to be able to sell on Sunday, you're going to have to give something up. That's the legislative process. And folks weren't willing to, give up enough.
Well, essentially, Representative Dermody told the Walmarts and the Krogers of the world that if you want Sunday sales in the worst way, we'll give them to you in the worst way.
That's essentially what happened. And so it was a question of whether they wanted to pony up for the new restrictions and the regulations. And ultimately, they decided they didn't. The bill as it came out initially had a certain level, and then it got amended and had a much more restrictive level and much more expensive for the people who, the big boxes and the other retailers. And at the end, they just, they didn't want to do that. And so I think that Dan is right. I think that the package stores said, we'll give this to you, but under these conditions, and they said, we don't like those conditions.
So are the consumers lost in the process? Their concerns?
Their concerns, I guess it comes down to being able to want to buy liquor, if that's your preference, on Sunday and buy it at whatever the closest store is.
The Wish TV Ball State Hoosier survey found that 52% favor Sunday sales, a majority.
Which doesn't surprise me. I mean, they were not the ones probably. Yes, there was a website. Yes, there was a petition drive, ostensibly to garner the support and mobilize consumers. But that's not really where this was being waged. I think this was some of the same cast of characters on both sides that we've seen before. You know, it was, I think, a victory. At least the battle went to the packaged liquor stores. But to your initial question about the long-term prospects, I think it's inevitable that there will be Sunday sales at some point, because I don't care what it is. If you're one of one or two states in the country that do things one way and 48 or 49 other states do it another way, I'll bet you any amount of money that eventually you're going to have to cave, because the economy is now national and global. You can't just isolate anymore.
The bottom line here is that this is not about morality. Sunday has nothing to do with it, right?
Well, I think at the end of the day, consumers are more concerned about, you know, being able to get it at their convenience, and they don't understand the difference. But there are certainly different perspectives, as Dan said earlier.
Well, will the bill be back next year? I've heard speculation that we're going to have another election before this comes about, because when you talk about the two sides fighting over this, it really comes down to campaign contributions, and they may need another opportunity to offer some campaign contributions to change some minds here, right? Is that too crass?
It's not a partisan issue. I mean, this is
It's not.
So, I mean, you can say you need another election. The reality is that you have to, you know, it's the legislative process. If you want something, you have to give something up.
And I really thought that this was the year that was going to happen. I was a little surprised when it went down in flames last week. We'll see what happens next time.
The liquor stores do have an argument.
They do.
Their folks have to be trained. You can walk into Kroger and buy beer and do the self-checkout. That's a huge difference.
But again, it used to be, you know, when these rules were put into effect, people were born in Indiana, they lived in Indiana, they died in Indiana, they were accustomed to what they were accustomed to.
That's part of the reason why they have a lot of power.
Right, but you also have a situation now where Indianapolis and other large urban centers, where you do have a lot more transients, and you do have companies starting here and moving employees in here, and all of a sudden, those are the people who are saying, wait a minute, what do you mean? I'm having this gathering and I can't get any beverages, and pretty soon there'll just be a friction point, more than there is now even.
You can go to your microbrew or your winery and get your goods on Sunday.
Yeah.
Or you could buy it on Saturday.
Moving on. The governor is opposed to an expansion of gambling, and the proposal for live dealers at racinos is intended to bring in more business. That's a conflict. Nevertheless, the House voted 75-18 in favor of the bill that also permits riverboat casinos to move on land. It's an effort to bolster a sagging gambling industry in Indiana, as new competition has surfaced in surrounding states. The debate in the House was relatively brief, as the author of the bill, Tom Dermody, argued that replacing the electronic dealers in Anderson and Shelbyville is not really an expansion.
If right now they have 48 e-table games or electronic table games, they will maintain 48, but they could convert up to half of those, 24 say, to live dealers.
So I think we have to figure out what is and what is not an expansion of gaming, live with that definition, and then see what we can do to help these institutions survive in a day of increased competition.
And that's Senate GOP leader David Long indicating that the Senate will consider the gambling bill. Dan Parker, how would you describe the governor's role in the gambling debate?
Non-existent.
Well, actually, this week he sent the word to the House that he didn't want the live dealers.
Well, the reason I say that is that obviously they didn't listen whatever he said. I mean,
they took the live dealers out, and then in the next vote they put them back in. Yeah.
I mean, this debate really should be about, yeah, we have an industry. It's not a cash cow anymore. How do we make it survive? And I would argue that the industry is in contraction, not expansion. So, you know, they have to do something if they want to continue to get the tax dollars.
That actually presents a difficult problem for the governor, doesn't it? Because he says that he's willing to go along with business changes that are
intended to make these people more competitive, but by definition, what they're trying to do is get more people to gamble more money. So at what point is it an expansion and one point isn't it?
Well, I think he's been very clear. He's against an expansion of gambling in the state, but at the same time, he's very open to making these businesses as competitive with the competition as possible.
So it all comes down to definitions, and he won't provide any definitions. Well, at least not publicly.
I think there have been certainly some discussions with leaders in the General Assembly. And, you know, I mean, he's allowing the legislative process to work.
This is one case where this is not where a state that works. Because for this industry, it's not working.
It's not working. And the governor was asked yesterday if he would spell out what he considers to be an expansion of gambling, whether it's live dealers or riverboats on land or whatever else. And he gave one-word answer. No. He won't spell it out.
And that shouldn't surprise you because Mike Pence, I mean, this is really pretty much par for the course with any number of issues. He's even said he likes to set the guardrails or whatever how he refers to it. And then what happens in the legislative process? And I guess if you set them widely enough or far enough apart, you're always going to be on the winning side. So this way...
It's called politics.
And we also,
but he's allowing the process
that's
to
called leading let me from
also,
behind.
Let me also point out, we don't know if this will stay standalone legislation or if this could show up in the budget bill at the end. Because remember how the casino industry started in this
in
state?
The budget bill.
In the first time. It was a last-minute budget bill in a special session. And so Evan Bayh, who didn't want it, ostensibly...
Why are you looking at me?
Well, you weren't born then, I guess. He ended up signing it.
Right.
And I could see a situation where the governor, you know, seems to hold his nose and signs what's been put in front of him.
Well, he's trying to leave himself in a position here where he can go along with pretty much anything.
I think that's absolutely right. Expansion of gambling is in the eye of the beholder and is a malleable definition. I think that they will get this through the Senate in some fashion. And I think it will be something that the governor will have to make a decision on at some point.
It looks like there's enough votes there for a veto override.
It's 78 to 12 or whatever that was.
Moving on, the soccer stadium bill is headed to the state Senate, where it can expect a chilly reception. But first, let's talk about the surprising 73-21 vote in the Indiana House this week. It was in favor of a plan to let team owners capture state tax money generated at the stadium and at a hotel now being developed downtown. Up to $5 million a year could be used to pay off bonds sold to finance the 18,500-seat stadium that would be home to the Indy 11, a team that has played just one season in the North American Soccer League. Here's State Representative Todd Houston, followed by State Representative John Bartlett.
There is a demand for this. There is a excitement around this. It's a league, the North American Soccer League, that consists of cities like New York, Atlanta, Tampa, San Antonio.
I know we talk about how we built up downtown Indianapolis, and if downtown Indianapolis is doing that great, let it support itself.
We're really focused on funding our priorities here, and those have to come first. And the soccer stadium makes fiscal sense. We'll certainly consider it.
And those are remarks made by Senate Leader David Long prior to that strong vote in the House. John Ketzenberger, does that bill get a hearing in the Senate?
Wow, that's an interesting prediction. I don't know. I really don't. There is stronger opposition to it in the Senate. The leadership of the committees, which would hear this, Senator Kennelly or Senator Hirschman, haven't exactly been very pro on all of this. So I wouldn't be surprised either way. I guess I'd be more surprised if it does get a hearing and does get a chance to move. The important thing for the people who are in favor of the bill is that it did get a strong reception in the House, and it's live language, so it's always negotiable at this point.
73 votes in the House. Minority Leader Scott Pelath said that he thinks that while that's broad support, it's not very deep. He said that was mostly a vote to keep the conversation alive.
I think that's probably a fair assessment, and that may explain the lopsided nature of this. Frankly, this session, you don't see 73 votes on much of anything unless you're saying, you know, we're endorsing the flag and apple pie.
And gaming.
And maybe gaming.
Yeah.
This is a form of gaming, maybe.
Yeah.
But it's, and I think you're right. Anything could happen yet, but I think it will clearly, I mean, this is a statement of the obvious, have a much tougher time in the Senate for the reasons John outlined than it did in the House.
Yet the governor
expressed some support for this idea this week, certainly indicated that he's open to it.
I think he sees it that they aren't using current tax revenues. The state's not losing dollars to finance the stadium. The owner, thanks to an amendment that was offered by Representative Delaney, has skin in the game. That's always been
to cover
a question
half the
that
debt.
People have.
Yeah.
And looks at it really as an economic development tool. I guess, you know, this is going to be a project that's going to be built in Indianapolis, financed through the CIB. It's time that, Joe Hogsett tells us where he is on the bill, too.
Well, I think that's an interesting point, running for mayor. Maybe Chuck Brewer, too, who's running for mayor. Couple of big issues here, though. We don't have a location identified for the stadium, and this downtown hotel being added to the mix using taxes from that, I think, is a big stumbling block for some folks.
I mean, there's several issues from this. I mean, just last week we had a debate in the General Assembly about common construction wages, and it was all about how the private market needed to be brought to bear.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to building a soccer stadium, it's everybody gets to feed at the trough. In terms of the debate about Indianapolis, I mean, what we're seeing lately is that anybody who wants to do development in Indianapolis is running for the city treasury or the state treasury. And it's probably going to be Joe Hogsett who has to clean up the mess and pay the bill when he becomes the next mayor.
Yeah, will he speak up first?
Well, I mean, the reality is, who isn't getting a deal at taxpayer expense in Indianapolis right now?
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should taxpayers help build a new soccer stadium? Your choices are A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, do you approve of the job being done by the Indiana General Assembly? 4% said yes, 95% said no, 1% said, ask me in May. By the way, a recent scientific poll gave 52% approval to the General Assembly. If you'd like to take part in our poll, however, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. The Indiana Department of Education says the Newcastle School District can investigate a letter-writing controversy. The group Stand for Children Indiana believes several fifth graders at Wilbur Wright Elementary were manipulated into lobbying for State School Superintendent Glenda Ritz. The group says several letters they wrote seem like they were written during class with help from teachers.
Kids need to be in school to learn and making every most out of every minute in our schools. And so if there's time being taken for kids to become little lobbyists and persuade them on policy or partisanship, that's just wrong. And I think every parent and all every leader across the community would want to put a stop to it.
Justin Old Miller there of Stand for Children, John Schwannis. Kids learn lots of things in school. Why not learn the ISTA talking points?
Wow. Jim, I'm not sure how to answer that. Well, clearly,
as long as they're clearly identified as ISTA talking
points. And I guess that's maybe the rub here, that the suggestion that these were all somehow just, you know, spontaneous expressions of opinion on the part of the students, many of whom maybe, you know, at the beginning of the semester might not have even been able to name the superintendent of public instruction, but maybe now couldn't even name the superintendent of public instruction. This is such a highly charged issue, and we already talk about, you know, how little instructional time there is. We've had the fight about 12-hour-long I-STEP plus exams, and this just is a natural extension. You figure it's going to get people all fired up. But I guess you could say these are the core constituents. They have every right, I guess, to have a stake in the argument.
The governor got tripped up over this a little bit because he was asked about it, and he said that politics has no place in the classroom. And then he was asked about him posing for pictures with charter school students.
It's one of those things that you do need to be careful about, because we are about the business of educating children in the state of Indiana. We spend more than half of our public treasury for kindergarten through 12th grade. It is our state's business. So when you try to do these kinds of things, it comes off as bad form. We should avoid that at every turn and worry about the policy and stop with the politicking.
Should there be an investigation?
Well, that's going to be up to the Newcastle schools. The articles out of Newcastle, the teacher probably regrets, you know, having going down this road. The whole thing's unfortunate. Unfortunately, the problem with this issue and a lot of others is that it's diverting attention from some of the real issues in the General Assembly related to education, particularly the fact that, you know, the House passed a school funding formula that, you know, wiped out another $14 million for IPS and even more, you know, even more money for the Fort Wayne Community Schools. Sorry, you know, have to point at you for Fort Wayne, but, you know, that's where the focus should be in terms of how we're underfunding at-risk kids in the state of Indiana, not on things like this.
Do you see a problem with what these kids did in Newcastle?
Well, I think the issue is, I think we all agree that politics shouldn't be in the classroom. And as Dan said, the teacher probably regrets how this all went down. You know, yeah, that's a problem.
You know what, though? We do need to be careful about blanket statements, because how many times have we read stories about schools that, as a project, they wanted to make the state fossil, the blankety-blank, or some law. They get together. They do
but
grassroots campaign.
But there's a process there.
Well, goodness gracious, this is probably how the process really happens. I mean, this is this is the kind of lobbying. So I think we need to be careful.
Saying you need to leave politics out of the classroom, it's tough to know where to draw that line,
because
right?
We would be lauding them. Their teacher would be Teacher of the Year if this were snail dart or fossil of the year or something.
Well, let's be honest here. You know, if you're looking at this and the students are only looking at one perspective, that's not the appropriate way. I have no idea what happened in the classroom and how they came to those conclusions. But at the end of the day, those students' names also should have been kept out of the mix.
Moving on, the governor is traveling this week, speaking at the conservative CPAC convention and at an event put on by the Conservative Club for Growth.
I'm going to talk about, in part, what's happening at the states. You know, I think the American people are tired of a Washington knows best mentality on the left and on the right. And I'm going to talk about what we've been able to accomplish here in the state of Indiana.
Dan Parker, what's the motive there?
To keep a non-existent presidential campaign at least somewhat alive. You know, the news, you know, Friday was that, you know, he didn't even get a prime speaking role. I've been pushed off to a side stage. So, I mean, this is really, he's not running for president. He just needs to come out and say it. I'm sure this is probably more about trying to be in front of national donors.
Well, I was going to say, even if he doesn't eventually run for president, having his name in front of national audiences will help him raise money for a reelection bid, right?
And it helps Indiana tell the story of our successes. And above all, isn't that what's really important here, to tell the success story of Indiana and to make individuals that are potentially looking to locate a business, grow a business in this state, think about Indiana?
And maybe lay some groundwork for another campaign in another election year?
Well, it's not as if he's a foreign concept to these people, that he's introducing himself.
He's right at home.
He won. He actually...
He's spoken at CPAC before.
Well, he's spoken there. I think he actually, as soon as I say this, I'll probably be proved wrong. I think he won a straw poll, a CPAC straw poll back maybe 6 years ago or so. I'm going to have to do some research on that. But he's a known commodity to these individuals.
Yeah.
It's old home week. He gets to go see his friends, gets to sell his wares, and, you know, that's part of the process and the grist.
Well, and the Club for Growth thing is advertised as being for presidential candidates, but it's helpful to know, isn't it, that Club for Growth is now run by David McIntosh.
That's right.
Who's from Indiana.
It has deep roots in Indiana.
Well, not just from Indiana.
Right. His predecessor from
the same congressional seat.
It would be nice if his governing philosophy that he was expressing in that video, you know, applied to the State House as well, you know, because the State House thinks they know best when it comes to cities and towns.
Finally, an Indiana woman has been crowned the National Watermelon Queen. Emily Brown of Vincennes beat out six other women during the National Watermelon Convention in La Quinta, California, to claim the crown. The 21-year-old will now travel the world promoting watermelon. She called it the experience of a lifetime. Tim Berry, aren't watermelon out of season?
In Indiana, promoting Hoosier agriculture, it's never out of season.
She was with John Gregg when he
New Year's Eve
when he dropped the
watermelon. I think that's why she won.
There's a political angle to this, do you think?
I think it could be a part of his campaign if he runs again.
Why have I never heard of Miss Watermelon before?
Because you're sadly uninformed, Jim. You just don't get around enough. Vincennes is watermelon heaven.
It is.
Well, it is.
It's true.
It is.
So get out more, Jim.
Okay, is this the, with the Beauty Queen, is that the way to promote watermelon sales, do you think?
Oh, Jim, I don't know. We must be running out of time if you're asking me a question like that. No, Look, I think it's great. Agriculture, supporting. There might be even be a special booth at the state fair next year for this. I don't know.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Dan Parker, Republican Tim Berry, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shella of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T, rethink possible.